This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
We will continue to look at the economic situation that we are facing in this country.
Will bailing out the banks to the tune of $700 billion fix the liquidity crisis, or will we need to nationalize the banks? And what about the growing threat of home foreclosures, unemployment, and contraction of the real economy? What is to be done? Later on, we'll talk with economist and author William Tabb. But first,
we have somebody who will help us analyze bailouts. And with that, we welcome Dean Baker. And Dean is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean, what's in the bailout package that is so destructive that people such as yourself feel that to hell with the bailout, or people like Dennis Kucinich or others who voted against it?
You're talking about transferring hundreds of billions of dollars from ordinary taxpayers to the Wall Street bankers that messed up on their jobs. And so the idea that you're going to take taxpayer dollars and give them to some of the absolute richest people in the country because they messed up so badly on their job that they're going to wreck their bank, that's a little hard to sell. The public has an interest in having a working financial system. We have zero interest in subsidizing the bankers or the shareholders of the banks that perform badly. That's their problem. There were no provisions in this bill that prevented that money from basically going into the pockets of executives and going to the shareholders. And this whole scenario that was drawn up by the Bush administration trying to push this through was a fiction. The economy is in bad shape, and the main reason it's in bad shape is because we had an $8 trillion housing bubble that's now in the process of collapsing. We've lost $4 to $5 trillion in housing wealth. That's on the order of 60,000 to 70,000 for every homeowner in the country. We're probably going to lose another $3 to $4 trillion over the span of the next year or so. That's the main source of our economic problems. Now, the financial sector problems are obviously part of the picture, but they originate in the housing sector. They're because we had this bubble that we should have attacked. This is the predictable outcome. The financial problems are part of the story, but they really are a sideshow. And what the administration has done is start jumping up and down, yelling these scare tactics that if we don't have something to do tomorrow, we're going to have the Great Depression. This is just silly. You know, we have serious problems. To be distracted by, you know, the president jumping up and down like a fool yelling Great Depression, there's no place for that. This absolutely deserved to be shot down. It was about giving taxpayers money from hardworking people to the richest people in the country on Wall Street because they don't know how to do their jobs. The really bad thing that could happen is you could have the financial system freeze up. You have Citigroup that doesn't trust Chase and they don't trust Bank of America, so no money changes hands. Now, the reason why that matters to the rest of us is we count on being able to get money from our bank accounts. That could freeze up and we wouldn't be able to do that. And that was this story, which really, really is a horrible story, except the next step in that story is the Federal Reserve Board steps in and takes over the banks. So if we got to that situation, I don't think we will, then the Federal Reserve Board absolutely must have contingency plans. It would be inconceivable that they don't, to take over the banks, keep them operating. It would be just like, you probably remember Indy Mac, one of the major banks was taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation about 2 months back. Most people who had deposits at Indy Mac probably had no idea that had been taken over by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. You know, if you go to the ATM, it was the exact same thing as if it had never been taken over. That situation, although, again, I don't want to trivialize it, we don't want to be there, it's a bad situation, but the idea that, you know, the economy is just going to come to a halt and, you know, we'll be back living in the Stone Age because we don't have money, that's not going to happen. Other than that, what you could say is, yeah, the banking system's somewhat of a drag on the economy, but the fact that Congress didn't pass a stimulus package is a drag on the economy. The main source of drag on the economy is we just lost $4 or $5 trillion in housing equity. That equity's now gone. So people are cutting back their spending. So we're having a recession because the housing bubble is deflating. It's a very painful process. And the banks are really the sidebar.
Yeah, it seems to me as this sort of comes across in the same way as the trickle-down theory, that if you fix the top, if you fix the financial sector, it would trickle down, but nobody's talking about the real economy. As part of the real economy, you have all of these mortgages that are threatening to go into default and foreclosure. Is there a way to fix that, and would that help to fix the real economy and the financial sector?
Well, again, this is another very big problem with the bill, that one of the provisions that the Democrats tried to get, and President Bush was just insistent he'd give no ground, was a change in basically reversing something that had just been put in 1991 that said when someone goes into bankruptcy proceedings, that the bankruptcy judge can't reevaluate the terms of a mortgage contract. If I'm in bankruptcy, the judge could look at my car loan, they could look at my credit card debt. You know, basically any debt I have, they could look at it and restructure it. The one debt that they're not allowed to do because of this 1991 provision is the mortgage debt. And what the Democrats proposed was that we at least temporarily change that. So we say we are in unusual circumstances here. You know, President Bush is warning us about the Great Depression. So we say, okay, bankruptcy judges could reevaluate the mortgage debt and adjust it so that people could stay in their homes. But, you know, President Bush insisted he's giving no ground on that. Similarly, there is wording there that promotes for the mortgage-backed securities that the government would inevitably come into possession, that they would try to get workout arrangements that allow people to stay in their home. Again, that was one of the good things I think the Democrats got in the bill. One problem I would say is that I think they could have gotten stronger language, both in terms of requiring it, but also the realities. When you own a mortgage-backed security, you don't actually own a mortgage. You own a claim to a payment on the mortgage, and the law ends up being very complex. The Democrats could have put in language that would have facilitated control over the actual mortgages so that, in effect, if the government owns a mortgage-backed security that basically gave them 70% of the interest flow from a specific mortgage, they could tell the servicer on that mortgage on that house that we want you to work out a deal that keeps the person in the house. That's been one of the problems with trying to keep people in their homes and avoid foreclosures. It's the ownership rights are so complex now that it's often hard to get an agreement, even if many of the parties would want to do it. It's generally the easiest thing for the servicer just to say, hey, I got a contract that says I didn't get paid 3 months, we didn't get the payment 3 months, foreclosed. That's the easiest thing. So they want to do the easiest thing. That's the way people are.
You had mentioned a stimulus package before. Is that a way to jumpstart the real economy? And how big should that be? I mean, the Democrats were talking about $60 billion, and they couldn't get any agreement on that.
Yeah, well, again, this just shows the bad faith, dishonesty, whatever term you want to use. We have a serious economic problem. Here's President Bush out there talking about the Great Depression, and the Democrats propose a $60 billion stimulus. You know, he doesn't like this item, that item. You negotiate, take some of this out, put some of that in. But he goes, no, I'm going to veto it. We're talking about $60 billion. To you and I, of course, it's huge money, but in terms of the federal budget, it's about 2% of the federal budget. It's not a lot of money. In terms of how that would affect the economy, it would be a plus. But, you know, we're in a really big downturn. I mean, this recession is likely to be the worst recession, at least since the one at the beginning of the 80s, and it actually wouldn't surprise me if it wasn't worse than the 80-82 recession. I mean, again, the problem was you let an $8 trillion housing bubble grow like that, you have really bad consequences.
Dean, as a precursor to the issue of the housing bubble, isn't the more fundamental problem the incredible stagnation of wages over an extended period of time that kind of pushed and pulled us to becoming a credit-based society? Wages aren't going anywhere. Yep. What is a worker to do but to borrow?
Absolutely. What we saw over, you know, if you compare the early post-World War II years with, you know, the last 25, 30 years, very different picture. You know, the period from the end of World War II at least into the 70s was one where the economy grew very rapidly, and everyone pretty much benefited more or less equally. You had workers getting good wage growth year after year, so it was 2% a year or so. So, you know, after 10 years, people were markedly better off than they'd been 10 years previously. That pretty much stopped in the 70s and certainly by the 80s. And from that point forward, most of the gains of economic growth went to those at the top. And we had two very big bubbles driving the economy. In the 90s, we had, of course, the stock bubble, and that created this huge consumption-driven boom where people were borrowing based on stock wealth or spending based on stock wealth. And again, we had a huge borrowing back in the 90s. And then we had the collapse of the stock bubble, of course, in 2000, 2001, too. And the economy fell into a recession in 2001, and the only thing that ever really got the economy going again was the housing bubble. So we've had this long period, really, where we've had very weak wage growth, and the only times the economy ever really grew at a healthy pace was when it was being driven by these bubbles, which, again, of course, the problem with that, bubbles burst, and it's not a healthy pattern. And to say we're seeing the fallout from the second one, the housing bubble, today, and it's obviously not very pretty.
And they put out $700 billion for this bailout, and it's called a bailout for a reason. Is there money left? I mean, people are starting to say, well, then we can't do this, then we can't do that. Even saw it in the presidential debates. Will the pressure be then to really cut back on everything?
Pressure will be there. I mean, it's really important to understand that's not accurate in the sense of economics, because in principle what we're doing is we're taking $700 billion and we're getting assets for it. Now, we're going to lose money. I'm not going to tell anyone. People are running around, some people at least, saying they think we're going to make money on this. That's not going to happen. We're going to lose money. We won't lose this whole $700 billion. So what it means is that, let's say we lose $250, $300 billion. Those are plausible numbers. It could be more. Let's hope it's less. That means that the debt come 2009 or 2010, the amount of debt that the government has, is somewhat higher than it used to be. Now, these are really huge numbers. But the important thing to understand is what matters is the size of the number relative to the size of the economy. And let's say we've raised our debt by $300 billion. That's equal to about 2% of GDP. I'm not going to tell you that's trivial, but the debt rises or falls by 2% of GDP all the time, and we don't even notice. So the idea that suddenly we're not going to have health care or, you know, pay for education or fix our bridges or, you know, do anything about the environment because the debt-to-GDP ratio is 2 percentage points higher, that's close to crazy. Now, I know people are pushing that line. I saw that moment in the debates where Jim Lehrer said that to the presidential candidates. The Washington Post here has already been jumping up and down, going, okay, now we got to cut Social Security. And so there are people who have an agenda to cut social programs who are, you know, they're already dripping at the mouth to make that sort of argument. But it's a bogus argument.
I guess the question is, so what is to be done? What is to be done?
We've abandoned, you know, our regulatory structure. We had this, you know, archaic regulatory structure from the Depression, which anyone could rightly argue by the 90s or even the 80s, you know, badly needed to be changed. But instead of changing it, we basically dismantled it. So we had no regulatory structure. I mean, it was just inviting the sort of nuttiness that we ended up with the housing bubble. I mean, again, we saw some of this already in the stock bubble, but it just went totally nuts in the last 4, 5, 6 years. We need a regulatory structure. We really don't have one. I'm troubled by having, you know, these giants, you know, Bank of America bought up Merrill Lynch, you know, and some other large banks as well. You know, the big ones, the Merrill Lynch, Citigroup and Bank of America just keep getting bigger and bigger, and that's concerned. And, you know, we could live with that. Canada has a very small number of very large banks. You could do that, but they have to be carefully regulated. You can't have a bank that size and just tell them, okay, whatever you feel like is fine. You know, they'll take advantage of consumers, and you run the risk that you're not going to get the sharpest folks on top, or maybe they'll be sharp, but, you know, they'll be sharp in a way that's going to bring down the bank and bring down the economy. We can't afford that.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, thanks for spending some time with us, and thanks for all the good analysis and work that you do on a regular basis. Picking on the lawyers this time, but I've got the big time corporate blues too, and that's Mike Stout. We're going to go to an interview with William Tabb, who is a formidable economist, to continue to try to understand more about what is happening and how to use it to mobilize in our interest. Bill, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Mimi.
So this bailout, what's it really about?
The bailout wouldn't have worked in the sense of getting us back to the way things were. Nothing much is going to do that. The situation is serious. The point I think is key is that you can save banks as institutions where people can safely put their money and businesses and individuals can borrow money for the things they need. without supporting this huge, huge, what should we call it, the basically unregulated part of the financial system, which is basically a gambling casino in which people promise things that they turn out not to be able to live up to and then want us to pay for those mistakes.
Bill, when you say you can save banks, is it possible that the Fed would come in if things became dire and basically take over the banks and things would run as normal? Is that possible in your view? And is it possible that the Fed should start another bank and lend directly to the public?
It wouldn't start another bank. It would just take over existing banks. What has always happened, and this is why the Republican claim that this is socialism is fairly preposterous, whenever, and this is true in many countries around the world, whenever it gets to this point, they have to nationalize the banks, and then they have to send in their accountants to figure out which banks are insolvent and which banks are illiquid. And the distinction is important for people because the two terms are confused. What Paulson is claiming is that the banks are illiquid. That is, they have perfectly good assets, but if they were sold in this time of panic, they would fetch 25 cents on the dollar. But if they were held to maturity, they would be worth four times as much. And so it's liquidity. They can't turn their assets into the full value. Insolvency means that your assets are less than your liabilities. You owe more than the value of what you've got. You're bankrupt. You're bust. You're finished. You're kaput. So what we need to do is figure out which of these banks has gone so far that basically they've destroyed themselves as businesses. They should be closed down. That wouldn't affect depositors who are insured up to $100,000 by FDIC, but the stockholders would all lose their money, the executives would be fired, and so on. And yes, when you went to the bank the next day, you wouldn't know the difference. Your teller would be there, your money would still be there, you could write checks, and your credit cards would be fine. And that's what they'll eventually have to do. But they don't want to do that because Paulson has spent his time as an investment banker forcing the federal government or encouraging the federal government with huge campaign contributions and other convincing things to get Goldman Sachs what it wanted, which was deregulation. This is a man who has worked to create the problem we're now in. And what he would like is for the taxpayer to help them get the game going again. He is not interested in the homeowners. He's interested in bailing out the derivatives and these fancy credit default swaps and so on, which are humongous. The market has something like $62 trillion in credit default swaps. And what these are is they are promises that if something goes bankrupt, whoever sold you this will pay you for the losses in the particular transaction. These are what Warren Buffett famously called weapons of financial mass destruction. So you've got this gambling casino built on what should be a system to finance ordinary transactions that people and businesses need. But sure, the government could run them, and you would go to the bank, and it'd be the same as it always was. The bank itself would be bankrupt, but it would keep carrying out its functions.
So it sounds like not much more than kind of privatizing gains and socializing losses.
Pretty much. It would be trying to return some of the losses to these people so that they would not lose out. And the threat, of course, is if you don't support this huge derivatives market, the whole thing will crash. Now, the thing is, the financial sector, up to about a year ago, year and a half before the problems developed, they were earning 40% of all the profits of all the corporations in America. Now, they used to earn like 2%, 4%, up to 10%. We used to produce real things. Now, the economy depends on debt, credit card debt, student debt, mortgages, car loans. Your big stores make more money on debt than they do on selling things. General Motors Acceptance Corporation, before GM had to get rid of it to raise some capital, and Sears, all of these companies made more on their credit cards and on their car loans than they did making cars or selling clothes and washing machines. And that's because the declining real income, the stagnation of worker income over the last 30 years, people have been forced to borrow to keep up their standard of living, and they're falling deeper and deeper in debt. Well, that's where these banks make money. Citibank last year made something like 27% of its total profits on credit cards. And that, of course, includes those nice $39 late fees and the interest and so on, that exorbitant interest that people are paying on back debt that they can't pay off. So it gets bigger and bigger, and more of what they send to the bank each month is interest on the interest on the interest. The corporations are doing that. The federal government's doing that. We've created an economy depending on debt because it is not able to produce things and then sell them to people and cut wages at the same time and expect people to buy the stuff.
So for 25 years, there's been a debt buildup, and we've been lurching from bailout to bailout. Of course, there was the savings and loan debacle, there was the Enron, and now the kind of mother load, if you will. So how has the financial sector really maneuvered to hijack the economy?
Well, they've first hijacked the government, and what we've had since at least 1980 with Ronald Reagan has been this magic of the market. Get government out of things. You have the Securities and Exchange Commission headed by Mr. Cox. Well, Bush put Cox in because Cox believed in deregulation and not controlling the very companies that the SEC is supposed to control. Instead, he was trying to further deregulate. The FCC, which controls the communications, TV, radio. They put Colin Powell's son in, a neoconservative right-winger who allows Murdoch to buy up and control more of the media and has Clear Channel own most of the radio stations in the big markets and so on. At the head of each of these government regulatory agencies, whether it's in the Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, regulating banks, they put people in these jobs who don't believe in regulation, but in fact go the exact opposite way. And in finance, this has enabled them to build up these huge gambles. And the gambles work really well as long as the economy's expanding. There's another term I need to introduce here called leverage. Leverage is you put very little of your own money in, and you borrow huge amounts of money. Then you take the huge amounts of money and you invest it. So let's say you had $100 and you invested it and you only got $1 profit, $1 back. Well, that would be 1% on $100. That's not very much. But if with your $100 you can borrow $10,000, and for each of those $100 you make a dollar, you are going to make a huge, huge amount of money because you've borrowed so much that even after you pay the interest, you are fabulously wealthy. That's what the hedge funds do. That's what the private equity firms, like the one that bought up Chrysler and is now squeezing its workers. It's all debt. And by allowing people to buy things without having the money because they could borrow it, allowing this kind of leverage, it was very profitable. As long as the economy was expanding and as long as prices of assets were going up. But as soon as they stopped going up, as happened with mortgages and housing, and they start going down, all that leverage works in the opposite direction. And so you have to sell off your assets to try and pay interest on the debt, and your creditors want their money back. And that's why it's such a mess for the financial sector. They were allowed to borrow these huge amounts, to take these huge risks, and now they want you to pay for it.
So, Bill, what should we be doing to improve the real economy?
Well, the subprime market is about $1 trillion in mortgages, $1 trillion. But the credit default swap derivatives are $62 trillion. Okay, $1 trillion versus $62 trillion. These credit default swap derivatives are built, many of them, on the subprime mortgages. They're betting on what will happen, who's going to pay, who's not going to pay, who's going to default, and so on. Now, what you should do, I think, is help the homeowners, help the people who take over all those mortgages. Let the judges negotiate the price down in bankruptcy court to the current value of the house and have people stay in their homes. Do this only for primary residents. not for speculators who bought lots of houses, not for, you know, ski homes and chalets in Aspen, but for homes ordinary people live in. If you do that, you will prevent throwing 600,000 people, which is what's coming up as these mortgages get reset. As I think a lot of your listeners know, people took out mortgages at variable interest rates, at very low sucker rates to get them in there, and these rates are being reset after 5 years at much higher rates, and people can't pay them, they'll lose their homes. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people losing their homes. That means other people who might want to sell their home and move to another place because a job is available can't sell their home because it's not worth any more than the homes that are in default, which the banks are selling at very low prices. So nobody can sell a home at anywhere near where it's worth. So by saving the homeowners, you also save the neighborhoods, you save the town governments whose tax receipts are falling and so on. And you let all the speculators go hang. They're not the ones who you should be saving, but it's the working people who were suckered into these mortgages and so on. So by directly dealing with the mortgage, the housing crisis itself, it's much cheaper than dealing with these huge, vast amounts of speculative derivatives and so on.
Bill Tabb, I thank you for the analysis and the insights, for your contribution to understanding the issues and what is to be done.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And to learn more about Building Bridges, go to our new webpage, www.buildingbridgesradio.org. www.buildingbridgesradio.org.